failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. My name is Dean Becker, and today our guests will include former DEA agent and current member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Mr. Saleh Castillo. We'll also hear from Chris Crane and Students for Sensible Drug Policy. But first up, we hear from Angel Raich, who just this week had her hearing before the Ninth Circuit for her right to life, for her medical necessity for medical marijuana.
My name is Angel Raich, and I had the case that went before the United States Supreme Court in 2004. I've been using medical cannabis since late 1997 for a multiple variety of different ailments, including wasting syndrome. I have a life-threatening wasting syndrome where I cannot, unfortunately, hold on to my weight without the use of cannabis. I also have fibromyalgia, degenerative joint disease, seizures. I have an inoperable brain tumor. The list literally goes on. And what complicates my health and complicates my condition so much is the fact that I'm not able to take the synthetic drugs that most patients around the country are able to take. When the federal government came into the state of California a couple of weeks after 9/11, and started raiding patients, caregivers, and providers, I just really felt like, you know, my life itself would also be in danger because of the fact that I was very high profile at the time. I spoke about medical cannabis publicly and extensively through the media for several years. I had been doing media since 1998 on this issue, both locally, nationally, and also internationally. And so the chances of me becoming raided were fairly high. We found that the federal government started raiding people that had become outspoken about the issue. And so what I did in October of 2002, I filed a lawsuit against the federal government, the DEA, namely, and the Attorney General of the United States to stop them from coming in my home, but also in the homes of all other patients, and raiding them, kicking in their doors, taking their medicine, prosecuting them, taking their property, and so on and so forth. And that case actually has been going up and down through the court system since October of 1992. In the United States Supreme Court, under the Commerce Clause argument, we had our hearing in the Supreme Court in November. We had a decision in the United States Supreme Court in June of 2005 where there was a 3-6 decision, and I lost, unfortunately, in the United States Supreme Court. However, having said that, I think that what is important to see in this is that we have made progress in the court system. When the Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative went before the Supreme Court in 2001, they came out with a 0-8 decision, whereas in my case, we gained 3 extra votes. And if I succeed in the Ninth Circuit, then my case will then be going before the United States Supreme Court again, probably sometime next year. My case actually had a hearing back in the Ninth Circuit on remand from the United States Supreme Court on March 27th of this year. And basically the issues that were before the court were some of the arguments that we had still briefed earlier in 2002. And those arguments left were the Fifth Amendment, the Ninth Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, and the Doctrine of Medical Necessity. Those arguments are what was presented to the court, mainly the right to life. Because of the fact that I'm not able to take other synthetic drugs, we feel that I have a due process claim and a claim under the Constitution, which is, you know, the right to life. And so this case talks a lot about the fundamental right to life, the fundamental liberty to life, and we talk a lot about enumerated rights, under the Constitution. Because I have a medical necessity to use cannabis, because without cannabis I would die, and therefore I do have a right to break the federal law if I have a medical necessity to the medication. And what you were seeing in the court is a lot of discussion about the right to life, the Ninth Amendment due process, coupled with the medical necessity argument. It is the argument of my team and my argument that I would never make it through a prosecution. I would never make it through the phase of even going before the judge, because if I am incarcerated, now mind you, I use a large amount of cannabis. Even though I am one single patient, they kind of look at me as being more large scale. If I don't medicate every 2 hours, you can visibly, physically see the decline in my health fairly immediately. And the same thing happens that once I use medical cannabis, you see an amazing difference in my body function and my ability to comprehend the things that are kind of going on around me. So if I was incarcerated and if I was in there for even a few hours, you would visibly see the decline in my health. The concern that we have is that because I have what is considered a life-threatening wasting syndrome, I just unfortunately cannot hold on to my weight without the cannabis. And because the doctors cannot pump other drugs in me, I lose weight fairly quickly. Without cannabis, I literally cannot take in the 3,000 calories that I need to take in a day to maintain the 98 to 100 pounds for which I weigh. Now, I am 5'4". I weigh 98 to 100 pounds. And if I was arrested in the federal system, and if I was even on bail or on probation, the federal court system does not allow the people that are on bail and on probation to even use cannabis for medicinal reasons. So if I was to follow the law, I would die. And I want to emphasize that you cannot tell what is going to happen in a court by the oral argument. We really have no way of knowing what the justices are going to do until the decision comes down. We still have a very good chance of getting a good decision in the Ninth Circuit. They definitely seem to really care an awful lot about this issue. If we get a decision out of the Ninth Circuit this time, I personally believe that the decision will be incredibly narrow, because you're going to find that because I and my medical conditions are so complex and complicated, and because my personal situation is so drastic without cannabis, you're going to find that if we get a decision, it may not cover every single patient that uses medical cannabis. It may only cover the patients that would die without cannabis. It may only consider and cover those patients that have a medical necessity to cannabis. In other words, it may only cover the 6 patients out there. It doesn't mean that other cases that are moving in the court systems will not come after a good decision in my case and make the arguments broader. The government is not as easy to fight as a lot of people think that it would be. And it's incredibly stressful also, I might add. But I think that what we really need to do is focus on, you know, what we need to do and what we can succeed at. I believe that the federal government does have the ability to regulate medical cannabis. And I think that they should do that. You know, they have blocked at every turn the research that we have tried to do on this issue. At every single turn, they have tried to stop that. And I think that the federal government is going to continue to do that. And I think that we need to brace ourselves. And whether or not we win in the court system, no one knows. But I think ultimately what we need to also try to do is we need to try to also communicate to Congress. And so I am not just out here on this battlefield attempting to knock down this issue in the court system, but I am also working very hard to lobby Congress. And I have teamed up with Montel Williams, and in the next 15 months or so, you're going to see us lobby Congress. You're going to see us work with the Hinchey and Rohrabacher Amendment. You're going to see us work more directly with the congressmen in this country to try to not only change the laws in the court system, but to try to change the laws in Congress. And so what I think that is really important is that more Americans rally around this issue, because personally, I am ill. I can only do so much on my own. I can only do so much as a patient. We need people that are not sick. We need people that are caregivers. We need people that don't even know much about this issue to continue to call Congress and try to change these laws.
What you've stated should be compelling, should be of great interest to the listeners out there. If they'd like to learn more about this case, I understand your transcripts will be online here soon. Please give them your website.
You can go to angeljustice.org, and all the pleadings in the case that have been filed to date are on the court documents page, and late Friday afternoon or Saturday of this week, the transcripts will be up online.
And now for another Black perspective on the drug war. If the disaster in New Orleans has taught us anything at all, it is that the Black community needs to become stronger and more self-reliant. The Black community needs warriors. But drugs weaken warriors. A warrior whose thinking is muddled by drugs is not able to answer the call to action, and so the community suffers. A warrior cannot be effective if he is dependent on something that is neither produced nor controlled by his own community. And the Black community, though it suffers from drugs, neither produces nor controls them. A drug conviction reduces your earning potential, your educational prospects, and your political power, and a prison stay exposes you to an environment rife with diseases like hepatitis and AIDS. But most importantly, involvement with drugs puts one directly in the crosshairs of the drug warriors who have no love for us and aggressively and unfairly target our communities. And a warrior locked behind bars is of no use to us at all. When the next crisis strikes, as it most assuredly will we be ready to march into battle? Only if we beat the twin demons of drug dependence and drug war first. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Phil Jackson.
I want to thank Mr. Jackson for that excellent report. As I understand it, folks up in the Midwest and the Northeast don't hear the stories that are coming out of Mexico, where daily killings are happening, bodies found burning by the roadside, police chiefs being shot out of the saddle, in a city where more than 700 federal drug agents are on duty. Cartel corruption is king.
My name's Celerino Cele Castillo III, and I'm a former DEA agent, and I've been in law enforcement for over 20 years, retired now, and trying to educate the public and what's going on with the so-called war on drugs and so forth.
Well, Sele, it seems that every day there's killings, people being found in car trunks or burning on the side of the road around Nuevo Laredo. Is that an example of the worst of the drug war?
Absolutely not. The worst is when it spills over, which it has already a little bit of a time, but spilling over into the U.S. Right now we just had according to my information, an informant who worked for the United States government killed and murdered in Starr County. His body was dragged and then was burned on recognition. He's one of many informants that are being killed, and people that corroborate with the U.S. authorities are getting killed and assassinated here in South Texas.
I want to think that this will change, that somehow one cartel will gain predominance, or that I guess idly hoping that the U.S. can do something about it. But this will continue as long as drugs are illegal, will it not?
Oh, absolutely. This will continue forever. The drug war has never worked. We've been doing this for over 40 years, and we tried the John Wayne approach, and it has not worked. Law enforcement is not working and has not worked in the past, so basically the answer to the war on drugs has got to be education, prevention, and treatment. And if you don't have a demand, you don't have any drugs. But according to a lot of the middle schools, there's a lot of kids still using drugs, and there's more of it, easier to get, and so forth. So we haven't made a dent, and you know, that seems to be a major problem. As long as you have a demand, you're going to have the product.
I have to sneak up on this. I don't mean to disparage anybody, but there are many within law enforcement that get corrupted by these dollars.
Absolutely. We have, as a matter of fact, just recently I got the intelligence that one of the major cartels came over into the United States and went and knocked on three U.S. Customs guys on their homes and told them to cease and desist from working with the different cartel, or else their families were going to be killed. And needless to say, within a week or so, they had asked for a transfer out. So that's how strong the cartels are. They're going to be coming in here and into U.S. And, you know, right now the corruption is so high, it's up all the way to the United States Attorney's Office to where they got people with the cartel working in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they know exactly when there's an indictment coming out and who the informants are and so forth. And that's why, you know, the corruption party is huge, and you know, it's getting worse now.
Well, Saleh, you're a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Tell us about that organization and what you guys are trying to do about this situation.
Well, it's an international organization that consists of many members, including federal judges and some agents, and they're still working, and former agents, former law enforcement people. And basically what we do, we go out and we talk about stopping the government from prosecuting individuals for marijuana possession and so forth, because basically what we got is the racial profiling is continuing, and it's ruining a whole bunch of our kids. Once you get a conviction on a drug, on a drug conviction, then nobody really wants to hire you. So that's the problem. We're trying to educate the public into what LEAP represents, and we have a lot of people that go out there and just speak, public speaking to different schools and organizations, and them to know that, you know, about marijuana and so forth. You know, I don't advocate people smoking or drinking. You know, I don't smoke, and I not want to tell somebody not to smoke or inhale whatever they want to into their system. But, you know, that's a freedom that the Constitution has given us.
Once again, that was Saleh Castillo, a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP.cc. Next up, we hear from Eric Sterling. He's the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation and a man who helped write many of the drug laws that are now in place across this nation. Eric, it seems that every year or two or three, there's a new wave of hysteria that circulates either within the United States or within a given state that entices our elected officials to escalate the drug laws. There's a situation in Delaware about Salvia. Tell us what's going on there, if you will.
There was a recent news story in the principal newspaper in Delaware about a young man who committed suicide. And the boy's parents say that he was a fine young man, a good student, and then he started using salvia, and they are suggesting that that was the factor that led to his suicide. As a consequence, the state legislature is considering a bill to make salvia a Schedule I controlled substance.
Well, Eric, you were the point man. I think I've heard you say it was your computer that helped put together many of the U.S. drug laws. And a lot of them followed the hysteria subsequent to the death of Lynn Bias, an up-and-coming basketball player. Your thoughts, sir, are we still following that same course of futility?
It's important to recognize that it is the job of the legislature to address the public's concerns. This is a democratic society. And if we had a legislature that said, we don't think the public has any common sense, we reject the public's views, that's not necessarily the kind of legislature the framers of the Constitution had in mind. So the real challenge is for the legislature to the test before it acts, the seriousness of the problems that the news media like to report. Remember, the business of the news media is to sell newspapers, attract viewers, get eyeballs on the screen so that advertising can be sold. You know, for hundreds of years, that has involved dramatic stories, tragedies, death, accident, crime. Those sell newspapers and lead the news accounts. We have to recognize that there is a logical economic reason for the news media to play up something new. Drug problems fit that category. When a viewer or a reader says, holy mackerel, or good grief, did you see this? That's a good news story. And that has been true with designer drugs, so-called look-alike drugs, ice, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, and even earlier, of course, LSD, and even in the 1930s and earlier, marijuana and other drugs. So that there has always been a relationship between the news media's promotion of a problem and the legislature's desire to fix the problem. The challenge for the legislature is not to get swept up into a state of hysteria. But that's very hard. Sophisticated legislators are willing to play to the excited concerns of the public, and that has happened repeatedly. And I've been in the middle of that in the 1980s when Congress did that.
This salvia is I don't know, after my time. I didn't ever try it. I don't know. You know, they say it only lasts a few minutes. I don't know the extent of its, ramifications of use. But I would envision that were we to make it illegal, that newer, more powerful extracts of salvia would be on the marketplace the next day. Your thoughts there?
I've had conversations with people who are very fond of it. What we saw with the ban of MDMA in 1985 was that these bans promote the popularity of a drug. MDMA, which we now know as ecstasy, was hardly known to the American people or to America's drug users prior to its ban. Its ban resulted in a cover story in Time magazine, and now, of course, it's a widely used illegal drug with a incredibly useful marketing name, ecstasy.
Once again, if folks would like to learn more about the work you do at the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation, please point them to your location on the web.
We're at www.cjpf.org. We have a variety of resources that your listeners might find valuable.
Okay, and we have just enough time to include an interview I did with the head of Students for Sensible Drug Policy, who just had a major victory.
My name is Chris Crane, and I'm the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy.
Well, Chris, you guys have been getting a lot of publicity in some major newspapers, the New York Times, for instance, and about your efforts and their understanding of the need for you guys to at least have access to information. Major success today. Tell us about it.
Well, what happened was actually about a year ago we filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Department of Education asking for a state-by-state breakdown of how many students had been denied federal financial aid as a result of a drug conviction. And the Department of Education got back to us saying that they would give us the information, but that we'd have to pay over $4,100 in administrative costs. Now, as a nonprofit organization, we are exempt from paying such costs. But they said that this information was not in the public interest, but was instead in our commercial interest, and that it would somehow lead to drug legalization and that SSDP would profit from that. So it was a completely bogus excuse that they used basically to silence us because they didn't want to give us the information. Well, we sued the Department of Education with the help of Public Citizen, and in less than 30 days, actually, the government came back to us and essentially gave up and gave in to all of our demands. They're going to be waiving the fee and producing the information by the end of this month.
Well, now, that certainly bodes well for your approach taken, and it perhaps bodes well for your suit against the federal government to end this unconstitutional prohibition of funding for students who get caught with drugs.
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, you know, if nothing else, this winning this lawsuit will, you know, we will get this data in hand. We will be able to show, you know, just how this has affected, how this law has affected students in every state in the country. You know, whether it's going to have an impact on the lawsuit that we filed with the ACLU challenging the constitutionality of the drug revision as a whole, it remains to be seen. We really don't know if this is going to have an impact on the other suit, but, you know, that other lawsuit that we launched with the ACLU is an incredibly important lawsuit. If we win that suit, the HEA aid elimination provision will be stricken from the law books altogether, and no student will ever again have to worry about losing their financial aid as a result of a drug conviction.
My perception is that you begin to expose the moralistic posturing that has brought forward some of these laws.
I think so, and I think, you know, the really important thing to take note of when it comes to us winning this Freedom of Information Act lawsuit is that this has a far-reaching effect beyond just Students for Sensible Drug Policy. This really sends a message to the federal government that they cannot withhold information from an organization or bully an organization around and not give them information they request simply because that organization has a message that they disagree with. The government has to be transparent. They have to turn over documents and information regardless of whether they like what an organization is going to do with that information. And that's really what this was all about. So this is a victory that goes well beyond Students for Sensible Drug Policy. This goes well beyond our, you know, ability to get our hands on really some very simple information. This is really about, you know, the government bullying small nonprofits into backing off of information requests simply because the government disagrees with their message.
Students for Sensible Drug Policy, tell us more about the organization, how many affiliates you might have, and where they can learn more on the web.
Well, we are a nationwide student organization that is working to involve students in the political process to try and change our current approach to the war on drugs. We've got chapters right now on about 55 campuses nationwide. We've also got activists who are not, you know, full-fledged chapters working under the SSDP name on about 100 campuses nationwide. We're one of the fastest-growing student organizations, period, in the country. If anybody's interested in getting involved with Students for Sensible Drug Policy or finding out more about our organization and what we do, and specifically, if you're interested in finding out about this lawsuit, you can go to www.ssdp.org/lawsuit. And you can find out more about it there. And in particular, we're really asking people to help us identify plaintiffs. We're looking for students who have lost their financial aid as a result of a drug conviction. And if there are any students out there who are listening, or any students out there, or people in general who are near college campuses who may know a student who's lost their aid as a result of a drug conviction, please get in touch with us. Send us an email to ssdp@ssdp.org, and that student may be eligible to join as a plaintiff on the lawsuit. And you can print out one-page flyers or quarter-page handouts that you can post around campuses that will help us identify students who have lost aid due to drug conviction who may be eligible to join as a plaintiff in this class action lawsuit.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the program. Once again, I remind you that there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. We have been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Prohibido is stock Ivalesco.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.